In this episode of Retire Smarter, we explore the intricate world of parental support and saving for the younger generation, with compelling statistics highlighting the strong emotional and financial ties between parents and young adults. We discuss smart gifting strategies, tax implications, and avenues for savings, such as 529 accounts, custodial accounts, and Roth accounts, all coming up today on Retire Smarter.
Hey, it's another edition of Retire Smarter. I'm Walter Storholt alongside Tyler Emmerich, certified financial planner and chartered financial analyst as well, with, of course, True Wealth Design, a wealth advisor on the team and someone here to help guide us each and every episode through the intricacies and the complexities of the financial landscape. If you'd like to set up a time to meet with Tyler and the team, you can do that by going to truewealthdesign.com. Look for the Are We Right For You button to schedule your time to visit. Tyler, it's great to be with you, and the podcast almost didn't happen today. You had a little snowstorm come through, and I guess if you got trapped inside, you'd still be able to do the show, so maybe it wasn't that much in jeopardy.
as long as I had electricity.
That's right.
But no,
that's the key.
We did. We got a little snow, although that's probably not the biggest thing I'm trying to get acclimated to from the weekend, because we had daylight savings.
Time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about your household, but mine is like on a strict regimen, and I feel like if any of us get off that regimen, it takes a while to get back in the groove. I had to actually wake up my two girls this morning. I can't remember the last time I had to go in the room and wake them up and get them ready for school. So we'll
That's
see.
Funny.
They're definitely taking a minute.
So it spilled over, not even from the Sunday initial shock, but into the beginning of the week as well.
Oh yeah, in the Monday morning. That's right. I had to cook breakfast by myself with not two little toddlers running around the kitchen this morning, which I can't tell you I don't even know the last time that's happened.
That's funny. You know, I think maybe it's something about being on the other side of 35 now. For the first time ever, daylight savings time affected me. Like, I've always just kind of thought, like, what is the big deal, people? It's 1 hour. And I'll tell you what, Sunday I was dragging at the start of the day. I was like, oh man, this is awful. So I've turned some sort of corner.
All right, come on though. You are in the camp that you like this better, right? This time, you know, lighter for longer. I'm definitely in that camp. I know some people aren't, but are you in that camp where
I suppose
hey,
I am. Yeah,
this?
I don't, okay. I don't know. I guess I definitely am. I guess that's the other thing too. This winter I have been affected a little bit more by the short days than in past years too. Kind of felt it a little bit, kind of wanting that little bit of a longer evening and that sort of thing. So yeah, I was in that side of the equation too, I think. So you're right, I'm happier for the longer day.
Okay.
In fact, noticed it right away on Sunday because we were coming back from something in the evening and I wanted to go out and take some pictures and I was like, we're not going to be back before dark. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, wait a second, no, it's going to be perfect. I've got an hour.
See?
I've got the golden hour. I can get out and get some good sunset photos, and oh, this will be perfect. So yeah, it does.
Look at you.
Does make things a little bit easier for catching your sunsets and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. So. Yeah, so you're already reaping the benefits.
Absolutely.
I'm glad I got you over into the other camp. Didn't take much convincing, but hey.
Yeah, you got it, my friend.
That's good.
Well,
so,
hey, we've got a great show on
the
way today. You teased this already, Tyler, that we're going to be talking about kind of some, you know, intergenerational or intragenerational conversations here, and one generation helping out and supporting the other. There's no surprise that this is kind of something that you would want to discuss and talk about. I know we've heard lots of different conversations over the years and new stats about sandwich generations, and it does seem like there's a lot of back and forth support between the generations. I don't know if it's necessarily more than ever, but certainly it's a big topic of conversation for, I think, any family preparing for their financial future right now.
Absolutely. I feel like it seems like anyway, you know, it comes up very frequently in conversations with our clients and families that we work with. What kind of prompted me to think about this for the podcast was I ran across some research through the Pew Research Center that, you know, kind of dove into that a little bit. You know, you had mentioned, hey, I don't know if statistically it's, you know, any, you know, the younger generation is getting any more help than they have in the past. And, you know, it does seem like if you kind of dive into the numbers a little bit, I wouldn't say there's anything too out there, too staggering or something that's out of the norm. But when you look into the numbers, it's about, well, 6 in 10 or about 60% or so of families say they've helped their children financially in the past year. And about a little over half, so almost 60% as well, are still younger adults are still living with their children. So I think that's a slight uptick from, at least from this study that was kind of referencing data from the past year against 1993 numbers. So I guess a slight uptick, but nonetheless, I think families all across are certainly helping their children in many different ways as they continue to grow and move into young adulthood and kind of start their lives.
Well, I know what we're going to explore here is kind of some of the, this being the show Retire Smarter, of course, some of the smart ways to do some of these transactional things within the family unit and talk about, I guess, gifting loans and the like when families are exchanging money and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I think we'll probably break it down into just two separate segments if we could today. You hit the first one right on nail on the head, right? I mean, smart ways to gift to your children and grandchildren. And then maybe we'll finish up and start thinking about just maybe smarter ways to save for your children towards the end of the podcast here. But, you know, when we think about gifting to your children, grandchildren, and the like, I get a question all the time. And I wanted to kind of start out with it. And that question, Walt, is, hey, do I get a tax deduction for gifting to my children?
Would be nice.
And it would be. But unfortunately, there is no tax deduction for gifting to your children. The only way for us to get that deduction, depending on your tax situation, money has to go to a charity or a 503c organization. So no tax deduction for gifting to your children, but there could be some tax considerations that we want to think about. And of course, when I think about smart ways to gift, taxes are always going to be in the back of my mind and something that we want to think through. So the first thing we want to think about is, well, how much can you gift to a family member on a year-in and year-out basis? And that number does change typically from year to year. And in 2024, you can gift $18,000 to one individual with no tax considerations tied to that. They call that the annual gift tax exclusion. Now, Walt, of course, there is, I guess, a little bit of details here that I always want to make sure that we're pointing out. And that is that that's $18,000 that you can gift to one individual. So if you are married, one individual
to one individual.
You got it. Okay. You got it. So, you know, if you and your spouse want to give your son or, you know, grandchild money, well, technically, then you can gift $18,000 and then your spouse would be able to gift $18,000 as well. And that would, so that totals $36,000 in that year that you could gift to them. So a minor detail, but for those of those listeners that are married and have a spouse, you know, that number is essentially doubled up to $36,000 a year.
And then could you potentially double that again if you wanted to give to both of your, like, let's say your spouse, your mm-hmm. son or daughter and their spouse?
Correct.
So as a family unit, you could, in theory, give $72,000 to your, you know, your quote unquote son or daughter. To their family
yes.
unit.
Okay. Absolutely. So pretty nice number. And the reason why that number becomes important is because if you want to go above that number, well, then there can eventually be or could be some tax considerations. There certainly is some tax considerations. What you would have to do if you gift over $18,000 to any one person is file a gift tax return in that year. And then depending on your estate and some other factors, that could eventually have some tax considerations for you down the road. So you want to be mindful of that $18,000 number. And if you want to go over it or gift any amount above it, well, you know, certainly there are some strategies out there. But if you don't use any of those strategies, then you will have to file that gift tax return because you gifted more than that annual exclusion amount.
And that would have implications for both you, the giver, and the receiver?
Potentially. Just depends on how the estate works out. It would depend on how that tax comes in. So what happens is if you go over the $18,000, that goes against your lifetime gifting limit. And depending on the size of your estate, there could be some tax considerations there.
Ah,
now,
gotcha. Okay.
We can get pretty granular here too, because another consideration here when you're thinking about smart ways to gift is, well, what do you gift? Of course, you know, cash, right, comes up, I think, quite a bit. But sometimes cash isn't always the best thing to gift. Sometimes gifting a highly appreciated investment might be a better source of gifting. So a scenario I think about that I ran into last year is I had a family who had an investment they'd had for a number of years. But a lot of times when you hold investments for a long period of time, there's gains in those investments. And if the family would have actually sold that investment and gifted the cash to their son, then they would have had to pay long-term capital gains tax on those gains inside the investments. And for this family, that would have been 15% tax on the gain of the investment. Whereas we had a chance to have a little bit more of an in-depth conversation and got to know and understand, you know, the son's financial situation. And it actually, in that scenario, made more sense to gift the actual investment itself over to the son. And then that way the son could then sell the investment. And then that tax on the capital gain now becomes his. But in his situation, of course, his taxes were a little different than his parents, and he actually paid no taxes on those gains. So there could be some considerations here on actually what you want to be gifting your children and grandchildren, depending on, you know, the insights that you have into their actual financial situation. You know, in that case, it saved that family 15% of the gains they had on that individual investment. So not a small chunk of change, especially as you think about larger dollar value gifts. Now, another thing that we might run into is if your child is still a dependent on your taxes, you got to be careful when you do these things because you could run into kiddie tax rules. You ever heard about kiddie tax law? No. Run across that one yet?
Okay. No. But I can imagine, yeah, if a child's still a dependent on your taxes, that just makes sense that that would kind of complicate things.
It does. It adds another layer of complexity because the IRS, you know, they don't want you to take advantage and just be gifting money to your children to avoid taxes. You know, in circumstances to where within the legal limit where you can do that, then sure, it makes sense. But when your child is still a dependent, you're providing their support and you gift them investments like that, well, they might go in and reach back and say, no, just because they don't make any money and they wouldn't be taxed on the capital gains, we're going to claw it back and make you pay taxes at your own rate. So those kiddie tax rules can get a little complex. So make sure if you are doing any type of gifting of appreciated investments, those are stocks, mutual funds, ETFs, I mean, could be anything, and your child is still a dependent, you need to be mindful of those kiddie tax rules. But thinking through this and understanding, well, hey, is cash or an investment, you know, make sense from the gift standpoint? You know, there could be some tax savings there. You're not deducting them from your taxes, Walt, but there could be some tax savings there, especially in the situation as we discussed, you know, with appreciated investments.
Okay, makes a lot of sense. I guess the money exchange between families doesn't always have to fall under the quote-unquote gift category, though, does it?
That's right. No, it doesn't. And sometimes I think it makes sense for it not to. And in these circumstances, we set up what's called an intra-family loan, which is a loan from you, the parent or grandparent, and to the family member. And, you know, the scenario that I can think about this, we ran into it actually a handful of times last year. Housing market is still very tight. Housing prices are expensive. And I don't know, Walt, if you've looked at interest rates are lately, but boy, we're still in the 6-7% range on mortgages.
Yeah. I'm happy to have something with a 5 in front of it, just from, right, from our move right before things even skyrocketed more. Yeah, for sure.
You got it. And those rates have been higher for longer. I mean, really all throughout 2023, you know, rates were in that 6-7% range if you were trying to buy a house. I mean, that could be very challenging for the younger generation, especially for those first time home buyers. They're, you know, contending with all cash offers and they're contending with high competition in these areas. And even if they got financing and got a deal going through, those financing rates, at least in the near term of what we've been used to, are what we would consider to be high. You know, we expand our horizon out and go back to the 80s. And, you know, I get a lot of comments where, hey, my first mortgage was in the, you know, 12% range or 13% range. So we certainly have seen interest rates this, you know, higher than where they are today. But in the more recent history, where interest rates were down in the 2.5-3% range for mortgages back in 2021, you know, that's a big difference. So families are really looking and saying, well, how can we help the younger generation get into their first home? And this family loan can be something that would be set up to help, you know, family members or the younger generation purchase that first home. It kind of avoids those higher interest rates, you know, and avoids and makes their offers a little bit more competitive, you know, when they are putting them in on those first time home purchases. So what happens is we can set up this intra-family loan, and it's very similar to, you know, if you're buying a house, a traditional mortgage, or this doesn't have to be for a first time home purchase. I just wanted to use that as a as an example that we ran into over the last year or so. With a couple families. But it can be for anything when you loan want to loan them money. Now, what the loan does is it allows you to, as the giver, to set parameters and have some flexibility on how and when you actually make those completed gifts. You know, you think of a scenario where you want to gift more than $18,000 a year to a family member, but yet you don't want to file that gift tax return. Well, a family loan can be a way where you actually can gift that money through the loan. So it's not technically a gift, but you loan it to that family member, and then there are parameters on how they pay you back, when they pay you back, what the term is on that loan. You really have quite a bit of flexibility on how you set this thing up. And a lot of times what some families will do is they'll set that loan up with, hey, I don't know if I want to make a completed gift right now, but maybe over the course of 5 years, I want to slowly forgive the loan amount, or no, I want them to actually pay it back after this certain event. So you maintain control as the individual that is actually loaning the money to the family member. And, you know, these things can be set up, you know, pretty easily, but you want to make sure that you're doing it smart. And what I mean by that is you want to have a lawyer, make sure you draft up the documents, you want it to be official, and then you want to have some type of tracking mechanism. That way, in the IRS's mind, you don't want to get into a scenario where that family loan is considered a completed gift, and then you would trigger some of those estate tax issues that we talked about if you gift over the $18,000. So there are some other caveats to be aware of where the, you know, the loan has to have a certain interest rate tied to them. These are called what we call AFR rates. And there are some other things to be mindful of. So you really do want to make sure that you have a professional, a legal professional drafting up the loan document, and then your financial professional on board helping you track this over the years. But, you know, that's what a good professional is going to be able to do for you, is get that set up, make it very easy, and have all the record keeping for you. So that way you can use this money and have some protections in place and not necessarily say, hey, here's an outright gift. You know, there are some parameters here that if certain circumstances kick in, you know, maybe you have them start paying back that loan, or you get that money back, or whatever the case may be. So a lot of flexibility. As I've said multiple times, I think flexibility is the term of the day, Walt.
But, yeah, I think it's one of the things too where, you know, that can be a tough one, the whole gifting money, but also loaning money. The either direction, you can deal with a lot of different preconceived notions and attitudes with clients. I mean, sometimes this comes down to the dollars, right, Tyler, when mm-hmm. you're working with clients. But I imagine other times you're kind of serving as a counselor, advice giver, just on the other sort of softer dynamics of something like this, when you're kind of helping families navigate through these things. Or am I wrong on that? Is it usually just about what makes the most financial sense?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think the financial understanding the financial benefit of it, that's probably the starting point. When we, you know, might, you know, start talking about an intra-family loan. But then, you know, the facilitation and the understanding of all parties involved, like, well, what are the expectations of this? You know, how do we see this coming to fruition? And then really kind of working out, you know, how this thing is going to be used over the next 5, 10 years or whatever the case may be in that particular family situation. But not only that, but it helps build a little bit of a, they've had families use it to build accountability to where they just didn't want to make an outright gift, but they wanted their child to have some skin in the game. And, you know, two, there is also some protections there to where, well, hey, if you your child is married and is purchasing a house together with their spouse, and heaven forbid it doesn't go in a good direction, and there is maybe a divorce down the road, you know, having a family loan in place can help, you know, protect your child in the case of a divorce, to, you know, kind of equalize that whole process and, you know, hold everybody accountable. So there are a multitude of different scenarios is where an intra-family loan might make sense, and you know, give the parent or grandparent control and power over a number of years to make sure that things come to fruition the way that they would like them to, and whatever the case may be.
Okay, very good. Well, those are all the ways to give and to help and assist, at least kind of that category number one that you talked about, Tyler. But I know you wanted to make sure we dedicate some time on the episode also just talking about more traditional savings methods or opportunities.
We do, yes. And the first one that comes to mind when I think a lot of families start thinking about how do I start saving for my child or grandchild are 529 accounts. I could see why. I mean, you look at the benefits of a 529, there are quite a few of them. Depending on the state that you're in, you might get some tax deductions for making contributions to a 529. I think about here in Ohio, you can deduct up to $4,000 per beneficiary on your state income tax return. You get tax-free growth, assuming you use that money for qualified education expenses. So this is something that you could start, when the child is very young. And then over the years, as the account continues to grow, you use it for its intended purpose, then hey, that growth becomes tax-free, which can be very, very powerful. And then we look at some recent legislation. We've talked about Secure Act 2.0 many times here on the podcast. It was signed in December of 2022. But it had some language in it that made 529 accounts even a little bit better, which allows individuals to use 529 money to transfer tax-free over to a Roth IRA. There are certain circumstances and criteria that you need to meet to be able to do that. So you want to make sure that you understand those and are working within them. But having the ability to, hey, we got through college, we got through school, there's still some money left in the 529. Uh-oh, what do we do with it? Well, hey, now there's some outs where you might be able to get that money over into a Roth IRA. So it helps alleviate or dampen that whole concern of the 529s where the, families go, well, hey, what if I put too much money in here? How do I get that money out? Well, hey, here's a nice, easy way for you to be able to do that and get that money out and still take advantage of some of those tax benefits that the 529 provides. But I also look at these 529 accounts and they have this handful of benefits, some better than others. But I also look at the 529s and there are a few things that I see over and over again where individuals maybe aren't using them to maximize the benefit that they provide. And the first of which is, I think a big one is using the 529 for private tuition for K through 12 education. I think a lot of individuals still think of those 529 accounts just for college, Walt. But there are rules to where you can pull out up to $10,000 per year from that 529 and use it for private tuition costs for K through 12, which I think is a huge benefit, especially if you're a family who has your children going to private high school or whatever the case may be.
Makes a lot of sense. Now, you don't want to make mistakes when it comes to these types of accounts, right?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's maximizing the benefit, right? And, a lot of times maybe there are small benefits, but, you're taking advantage of over a number of years, those benefits can add up. There was another thing where we had to be very mindful of who was the 529 account owner. Was the grandparent the owner? Was the parent the owner? And that kind of played into when you filled out FAFSA, how the 529 money was considered towards that. There have been some new rules passed which have lightened that to make it to where, the actual account owner isn't as big a deal now, to where if you're a grandparent, you have the 529s in your name. It's not as big a deal as it once was. So, having the appropriate account owner is not something we necessarily need to pay as much attention to or has as much financial impact as it did prior. But, the final thing is I think about these 529s is really making sure that you have a game plan for how to use them, especially once your child moves on to college, because there are a multitude of tax benefits as you think about, covering education costs. There's the American Opportunity Tax Credit. There's the Lifetime Learning Credit. And there are all sorts of rules around, well, hey, if you use 529 money to pay for the education expenses and you don't have a certain amount coming out of your pocket outside of the 529, you could miss out on some of these tax credits. And these tax credits are not insignificant. We're talking, you know, just over a couple thousand dollars a year that you could get back in the form of a tax credit, depending on how you are actually paying for those college education expenses. So you want to make sure that you're not just blindly saying, hey, I'm using my 529 for all of those college expenses. You might miss an opportunity to pick up some tax credits on your return. But all in all, the 529 accounts, I mean, I think are, you know, a good place to start as you start thinking about saving, you know, for your children. But there are a couple others that I want to point out. And then one I run into quite a bit is just what we call a custodial account. So Walt, have you ran into these at all? I mean, I think of them like just a general savings account at the local bank in the name of the child.
Yeah, I think now you're obviously ringing bells by talking about that. I'm pretty sure that this is what my grandmother did for me when I was growing up on my mom's side. She had a custodial account set up with Fidelity and would gift you know, small amounts of stock over the years for birthdays and Christmases and things like that.
Well, that is great. And you picked up a really key point there that I want to point out is that your grandmother had gifted stock and investments, because these custodial accounts, that's where they can be substantially different than just using a savings account in the child's name at a local bank, right? The custodial accounts actually work just like any other taxable brokerage account, to where you can actually hold investments inside of them, whether those investments are mutual funds, ETFs, or the like, they're all available inside of there. So you can treat it as a longer term investment and, you know, invest it in the market based off, you know, the child's risk comfortability, and, you know, hopefully you'll get more return over the long run than just having it into your traditional savings account. Now, a couple things that we need to be cautious of with the custodial accounts. You know, going back to earlier in the podcast where I mentioned those kiddie tax rules, Walt, these kind of come into play again, especially as we start looking at investments, because those investments might kick off portfolio income, capital gains distributions, and the like. And once those accounts start to get too high, what can happen is those gains can become high enough to trigger kiddie tax, which can then flow back through on the parent's tax return. So we really need to be mindful of, well, what type of investments are we holding into these custodial accounts, and how much portfolio income are they kicking off for the child or grandchild? So that way we can be mindful of, you know, the accounts from a tax situation. But, you know, while the child is considered a minor, what happens is it's ran by the parent or grandparent. So the money can be used for the benefit of the child at any time. And then once they become of age, they get access to the account and then gain full control over it at that time. So I think these custodial accounts have a big leg up on just opening up a just savings account at your local bank account. You mentioned Fidelity, you know, any custodian will be able to hold these things and get them set up and, you know, start actually investing for your child or grandchild.
Yeah, it's pretty helpful when you have some of these different flexibilities and things that you can lean on, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. But there is one other account that I would probably put a little bit better than a custodial account, okay, if you can swing it, and that's a Roth account. Now, I know you've heard Roth account many a times.
Oh, yeah.
Shoot, all the listeners, right? I mean, most retirees are probably hearing me say, hey, we got to do Roth conversions. We got to try to get money into a Roth for our retirees. So that that concept is really no different, especially for the younger generation. These Roth accounts can be wonderful places for where, when you gift money to your children or grandchildren, they can then take that money and then fund a Roth account with it. Now, of course, with the Roth account, there is a little caveat. I wouldn't say little, it's actually a big caveat. The individual has to have some type of earned income to be able to make contributions to the Roth account. So, and that amount of earned income can determine how much money can actually be contributed to the Roth. So the Roth could be great for, you know, teenagers who have like summer jobs, who have some income coming in, or individuals that are just graduating college and they're just getting started in their career. You know, a lot of expenses at that time in life. You as the, you know, maybe grandparent want to help them, you know, get started and make sure they're still saving for retirement. Well, helping them out with a Roth contribution because they do have some earned income could be a tremendous way to give them a foundation or start the foundation for, you know, longer term savings for retirement. And of course, the Roth account, you know, there are some options on where they might even be able to get access to that money for a down payment on a house or, you know, some other things. So it doesn't necessarily just have to be set aside for retirement money, but those Roth accounts, because they'll grow tax-free, are just really tremendous places for younger professionals and the younger generation to start putting some money. And if you can help with that, that'll give them a huge leg up as they start their careers or whatever the case may be.
Well, we covered a ton of ground today, Tyler, from gifting to talking about then kind of those intra-family loan agreements, mm-hmm. 529 accounts, custodial accounts, and now this Roth option for family giving. It's just fantastic that families do have a lot of these resources and flexibilities to help each other out, to try to make financial sense, and just help kind of guide us through this complex financial world we always talk about here. And it's neat that you can get that family support in a variety of ways. And thanks for detailing all of those different ways for us on the show today.
Oh, yeah. Happy to do it.
Absolutely. Well, hey, if you need this kind of planning, creative, true wealth design, I mean, that's the name of the company, obviously, mm-hmm. and want to retire smarter, the name of the show, that's why we're here, to help you learn a little bit more about the financial landscape and how you can take best advantage of it for you and your family and your situations. So if you want to talk a little bit more in depth about your particular situation, you can see the need from all the different things we talked about today to getting that customized advice, not just off-the-shelf kind of guidance. Definitely reach out. See if you're a good fit to work with the True Wealth team. All you have to do is go to truewealthdesign.com and click on the Are We Right For You button to schedule a 15-minute introductory call with an experienced advisor on the team. And then you can work with Tyler Emmerich, Kevin Krosky, and the great folks at True Wealth Design. Again, just go to truewealthdesign.com or you can call 855-TWD-PLAN. 855-TWD-PLAN and start your conversation that way, and you'll be well on your way to building your confidence when it comes to your financial future. Well, Tyler, thanks for all the help on this week's show. Really appreciate it. Good luck recovering from that lost hour this weekend, and we'll be chatting with you again in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we'll do. It's fun.
Sounds good. That's Tyler Emmerich. I'm Walter Storholt. We'll see you next time right back here on Retire Smarter.
Information provided is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment, tax, or legal advice. Information is obtained from sources that are deemed to be reliable, but their accurateness and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All performance reference is historical and not an indication of future results. Benchmark indices are hypothetical and do not include any investment fees.